political lesson. She was far more of a strategic politician than her image of a tough straight talker let on, and her personal analysis of the milk issue showed just how much. I had incurred the maximum of political odium for the minimum of political benefit. I and my colleagues were caught up in battles with local authorities for months, during which we suffered constant sniping in the media, all for a saving of £9 million, which could have been cut from the capital budget with scarcely a ripple. I resolved not to make the same mistake again. In future, if I were to be hanged, it would be for a sheep, not a lamb, still less a cow. For his part, despite major conflict between the state government and students in Berkeley that left one dead and dozens injured, Reagan was re-elected governor in 1970 over Speaker of the California Assembly, Jason Unruh, also known as Big Daddy. 2 years after that, Richard Nixon was re-elected as president over Democrat George McGovern by margins similar to the LBJ Goldwater contest, 61-38%. The American electorate was enormously volatile in that era, both on the state and national level, as huge percentages of voters switched between the parties during every election. This was partly due to a growing ideological realignment, as conservatives increasingly tended to drift toward the GOP, while progressives joined the Democrats. In 1973, Nixon's running mate Spiro Agnew became the second vice president to resign from office, avoiding jail time on corruption charges by pleading no contest. Writing in 1980, Agnew maintained that he had done so because he felt his life had been threatened. I was close enough to the presidency to know that the office could exert tremendous power. I had attended secret sessions of the National Security Council and knew something about the functioning of the intelligence community. Since the revelations have come out about the CIA's attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro and other foreign leaders, I realized even more than before that I might have been in great danger. I feared for my life. If a decision had been made to eliminate me through an automobile accident, a fake suicide, or whatever, the order would not have been traced back to the White House any more than the Get Castro orders were ever traced to their source. Agnew's replacement as vice president was House Republican leader Gerald Ford. Ford was well-liked in Washington, and the former football player from Michigan had a reputation for being squeaky clean, qualities that got him confirmed by large bipartisan congressional majorities. By 1974, the Watergate investigation and subsequent revelation of secret White House tape recordings were making it increasingly difficult for Richard Nixon to remain as president. Nixon wasn't the only one in danger. The head of the Watergate hotel burglary, G. Gordon Liddy, had similar concerns to Agnew regarding what the federal government was capable of. He had been party to White House discussions about the feasibility of drugging Pentagon Papers leaker Daniel Ellsberg and of assassinating reporter Jack Anderson. Liddy recounted his concerns about being killed during a conversation with White House counsel John Dean. It would be reasonable. The stakes, the sure loss of the presidency, were immensely higher, and after all, it was my fault. That raised another problem. So far as I knew, I was the only one readily available to the White House for domestic sanctioned killing. What was left to them? What was left would be some well-motivated amateur who didn't know the rules. I didn't mind being killed if that was thought necessary, but I didn't want some scared-to-death non-professional to try it at my home or anywhere else where my family could be endangered. I had visions of shotgun blasts through the kitchen window on a Sunday morning while we were all at breakfast. I said I was the captain of the ship when she hit the reef, and I'm prepared to go down with it. If someone wants to shoot me, Dean's head snapped up and stared at me, just tell me what corner to stand on and I'll be there, okay? Dean searched my face to see whether I was joking. I wasn't, and he could see that. He stammered, I don't think we've gotten there yet, Gordon. The senator who finally got tasked with telling Nixon that he no longer had enough Senate Republican support to avoid being removed from office was none other than Barry Goldwater. On August 9, 1974, Gerald Ford, who had never run on a national or even statewide ticket, became president of the United States. Less than 1 month later, on September 8th, Ford used his newfound presidential powers to pardon Nixon. It reeked of a quid pro quo, more corruption from the most corrupt administration in United States history. The national outrage was apoplectic. Even partisan Republicans were dumbfounded. As Goldwater later wrote, Ford called me just after granting the pardon, but before announcing it. It was 4 a.m. when the phone rang in Newport Beach, California, where my wife Peggy and I were on vacation. I said, Mr. President, you have no right and no power to do that. Nixon has never been charged or convicted of anything, so what are you pardoning him of? It doesn't make sense. Ford said, the public has the right to know that in the eyes of the president, Nixon is clear. I was stunned by Ford's words. This was the same man who had openly admitted that Nixon had deceived the Congress. This was most likely a criminal act, obstruction of justice. I replied, he may be clear in your eyes, but he's not clear in mine. The volatile American political situation was paralleled in the UK as energy costs began to go through the roof under the reigning conservatives. Starting on New Year's Day, 1974, commercial usage of electricity was limited to 3 days per week and working overtime was prohibited, though essential services were exempt from this rule. Television companies were ordered to stop broadcasting after 10:30 p.m. Under Queen Victoria, it had truthfully been said that the sun never sets on the British Empire because it stretched across the globe. By the time of Queen Elizabeth II, however, the British couldn't even keep the lights on at home. In the aftermath of the introduction of the three-day week, Prime Minister Ed Heath called an election for February 1974. Though his government fell, the result was effectively a draw. 301 Labour seats to 297 for Heath's Tories, the balance being held by various minor parties. The new Labour government immediately increased miners' wages by 35% upon assuming office. While this sounds extreme, UK inflation hit 16% in 1974 and would almost reach 27% the following year. Not being able to govern with such a small margin, now it was Labour Prime Minister Harold Wilson who called an election for that October. A majority of 318 seats is needed in Parliament, and Wilson received 319. With both parties in close ideological alignment, it became almost impossible to persuade swing voters to choose anyone other than those whom they had chosen at the last election. And with both parties in close ideological alignment, it became clear that neither one had the ability to take on the problems that Great Britain was facing. Some began to regard this karma for imperialism, that a nation that had pillaged so many others didn't deserve to thrive on its own. One person who did not hold to this point of view was Tory MP Ari Neave, who had successfully escaped from a Nazi POW camp only to later be given the honor of reading the indictment to the defendants at Nuremberg. Neave told Heath that he needed to stand down as leader for the sake of the Tories, but Heath refused. What Heath did eventually agree to was a change in the rules to allow a sitting leader to be challenged. Neave then asked three other men to stand against Heath, offering to be their campaign manager, but all refused. Then Neave asked a woman, Margaret Thatcher. Her vision was of a Tory party that stood for right-wing principles clearly distinct from Labour's, with the voters allowed to have a choice, not an echo. Unlike the British political consensus at the time, Thatcher was an advocate of privatization, deregulation, lowering taxes, and reining in government spending. Consensus doesn't really give you any direction in life, she later said. In January 1975, Heath put himself up for a vote in order to reaffirm his leadership of the Conservatives. In politics, it's not unusual for a stalking horse candidate to emerge in these sorts of situations. Such a candidate isn't taken seriously themselves, but the level of their support is intended to measure the strength of the sitting leader. If the leader won, then that is that. But if they were shown to be vulnerable, then other, more legitimate candidates could emerge from hiding to challenge them. Thatcher's challenge to Heath was regarded as a bit of a stalking horse campaign, but also as a bit of a joke. Her shtick was that she was the frugal conservative housewife and she was regarded as more of a nag than a leader. Under the new rules, Heath needed two things to happen to avoid a second round runoff and win outright: the support of a majority of the 276 conservative MPs and a lead of 15% of the vote over Thatcher and a minor third candidate. He ended up getting neither. When the votes were cast, Heath received 119 votes to Thatcher's 130 in the first round. He withdrew before the second ballot, and Thatcher handily defeated the three new men who thereupon decided to try becoming leader of the Conservative Party. For the first time in history, a major Western political party would be headed by a woman. And not just a woman, but that woman. Or as she became known behind closed doors, TBW, that bloody woman. It was Red Star, a Soviet Army newspaper, that then gave her the nickname that stuck with Thatcher throughout her life, the Iron Lady. Soon after her election as Tory leader, the U.S. Embassy in London sent Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, architect of détente, a classified diplomatic cable assessing Thatcher's prospects. It was a startlingly accurate and downright prescient look at her strengths and weaknesses, down to how annoying many voters found her literal voice to be. Margaret Thatcher has blazed into national prominence almost literally from out of nowhere. When she first indicated that she intended to stand against Ted Heath for leadership of the Conservative Party, few took her challenge seriously, and fewer still believed it would succeed. She had never been a member of the inner circle of Tory power brokers, and no politician in modern times has come to the leadership of either major party with such a narrow range of prior experience. There is general agreement among friends and critics alike that she's an effective and forceful parliamentary performer. She has a quick, if not profound, mind, and works hard to master the most complicated brief. She fights her corner with skill and toughness, but can be flexible when pressed. In dealing with the media or with subordinates, she tends to be crisp and a trifle patronizing. With colleagues, she is honest and straightforward, if not excessively considered of their vanities. Civil servants at the Ministry of Education found her autocratic. She has the courage of her convictions, and once she has reached a decision to act, is unlikely to be deflected by any but the most persuasive arguments. Self-confident and self-disciplined, she gives every promise of being a strong leader. Even before her great leap upward, Mrs. Thatcher had been the personification of a British middle-class dream come true. Born the daughter of a grocer, she had, by dint of her own abilities and application, won through, securing scholarships to good schools, making a success of her chosen career, and marrying advantageously. It is not surprising, then, that she espouses the middle-class values of thrift, hard work, and law and order, that she believes in individual choice, maximum freedom for market forces, and minimal power for the state. Hers is the genuine voice of a beleaguered bourgeoisie, anxious about its eroding economic power, and determined determined to arrest society's seemingly inexorable trend towards collectivism. Somewhat unchivalrously, Labour's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Dennis Healey, has dubbed her La Passionaria of Middle-Class Privilege. Unfortunately for her prospects of becoming a national, as distinct from a party leader, she has over the years acquired a distinctly upper-middle-class personal image. Her immaculate grooming, her imperious manner, her conventional and somewhat forced charm, and above all, her plummy voice stamp her as the quintessential suburban matron and frightfully English to boot. None of this goes down well with the working class of England, one-third of which used to vote Conservative, to say nothing of all classes in the Celtic fringes of this island. What was good for the goose was good for the gander. If the moderate Ed Heath could be knocked from his party leadership by a right-winger, then maybe, just maybe, so could President Ford. There was no question that Ford was on shaky ground, even independently of his pardon of Richard Nixon. Unemployment hit 8.8% under his presidency, with inflation reaching over 12% in 1974 alone. Just as with the British politicians, Ford seemed excruciatingly incompetent when it came to meeting this challenge. His campaign to whip inflation now, complete with win buttons, seemed both clueless and pointless. The premise may have been a sound one, a rejection of Nixon's wage and price controls in favor of private citizens doing their part to stem inflations. Suggestions like having more Americans plant vegetable gardens, turn down their thermostats and carpool as a way of cutting down on energy use and helping to restrain prices do not even pretend to address the root causes of inflation or even to identify them. The rising prices and falling buying power of the dollar were a function of things like the money supply, cost of production, and prices set by business, none of which the average citizen had much control over. But was taking down a sitting president too much, even for the always underestimated Ronald Reagan? The last time an incumbent had been denied his party's nomination had been an ailing Chester A. Arthur in 1884, and akin to Ford, Arthur had been a vice president who only succeeded to the Oval Office when James Garfield was assassinated. Yet there was still some more recent precedent. A few years after LBJ's heroic landslide win against Barry Goldwater, Senator Eugene McCarthy's upstart 1968 campaign caused the president to declare that he would not be seeking re-election. In 1976, for the first time in history, every state would have a primary or caucus to determine their delegates to the Republican convention instead of having party bosses control some of the votes. For Reagan, this was a golden opportunity due to his enormous appeal to the party faithful that disproportionately make up primary voters. But though unelected, Gerald Ford still had the power of the presidency at his disposal. It was much more impressive to get a phone call from the White House than from Ronald Reagan's campaign bus, and Ford knew how to leverage the power of the Oval Office to get the support he needed. One of the biggest issues separating the Republican candidates was America's attitude toward the Soviet Union. Under the principles of détente, any acts that could be perceived as hostile would preferably be avoided. And, of course, Soviet leaders had no qualms about attacking anything they disliked as a provocation. Yet cracks were nevertheless beginning to appear in Russian society for one big reason: technology. The ability to spread information was becoming cheaper and easier. The Soviet bloc witnessed the rise of samizdata, blurry photocopies of forbidden text secretly passed around by the citizens. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago revealed the practices of the Soviet prison camp system to the world and was banned in the USSR. Now it began to be read, and citizens in communist countries understood that the work, unlike what was in Pravda that day, was truthful in all its essentials. Solzhenitsyn avoided execution and was merely arrested and expelled from the USSR. Yet President Gerald Ford publicly refused to meet with him for fear of offending the Russians. By the time of the Republican convention in 1976, no one had any idea what the outcome would be. President Ford entered having won 26 states to Reagan's 24. Both candidates claimed to have enough delegates to win. Neither were correct, and both men were experienced enough to understand that a delegate's pledge was worth only as much as it could benefit them or their state. Reagan was also 65 years old, older than Eisenhower had been when he was first elected, and older than anyone elected president since James Buchanan in 1856, universally regarded as one of the worst presidents. Ford was merely 2 years younger, but he was the sitting president at the time. It was supposedly now or never for Reagan, whereas this was Ford's opportunity to prove that his presidency was something that he had earned and not some mere historic fluke. Reagan made an enormous blunder before the convention started. In the early days of the United States, where North and South had such different cultures, geographic balance was the name of the game for presidential tickets. One candidate from the Northeast would pair with one from the South to assure that there wouldn't be dominance of one part of the country over another. Over time, this somewhat gave way to ideological balance, with centrists choosing more hardcore partisans, or vice versa, as their running mates to gin up the party's base. In 1952, for example, Richard Nixon was seen as being firmly on the right, and the largely non-ideological Dwight Eisenhower selected him as VP as a sop to the Republican base. Goldwater was a notable exception to this rule, choosing unknown New York Congressman Bill Miller for VP on the grounds that he drives Johnson nuts. Historically, a candidate only announced their running mate once their nomination had been secured. In 1976, traditionalist Reagan decided to break with precedent, and in July, a month before the convention, he announced that his choice for VP would be moderate, read liberal, Pennsylvania Senator Richard Schweiker. Reagan's supporters were aghast. For years, they had witnessed establishment Republicans sing their tune during the elections and then promptly govern like Democrats the second that they landed in Washington. Reagan was supposed to be different, yet before he had even been nominated, let alone elected, he had picked as his number two a senator who had been endorsed by the AFL-CIO over a Democratic opponent. Ford won the nomination and, despite mounting an impressive campaign, lost to Georgia Governor Jimmy Carter in the fall. While President Carter's inauguration did little to change American economic woes, things in the United Kingdom got worse and worse under Jim Callaghan's Labour government. Late 1978 saw the winter of discontent, Britain's largest labor stoppage since 1926. First came a strike by Ford Motors employees, one that was soon supported by the Transport and General Workers Union. Then came the lorry drivers, the UK's equivalent of the Teamsters. Gas stations closed down, and distribution channels within the country were crippled. Then the railwaymen had their turn. On January 22, 1979, there was a wide-scale day of action as over 1.5 million workers went on strike. Schools shut down and airports were closed. After that, the ambulance drivers struck, though still responding to emergency calls in many, but not all, areas. The 1,100 National Health Service hospitals under Britain's socialized system were reduced to only treating emergencies. For a couple of weeks, even the gravediggers went on strike. The sick were not getting help, and the dead were not getting buried. When the trash collectors went on strike, the rubbish in London's famed Leicester Square soon stood taller than the people. The United Kingdom was fast becoming a dystopian novel. On March 28, 1979, Leader of the Opposition, Margaret Thatcher, stood on the floor of the House of Commons and said, "Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that this House has no confidence in Her Majesty's government." Labour only needed a majority of the vote to avoid having to call an election, and there were plenty of seats from minor parties that Prime Minister Callaghan could cut deals with to maintain his hold on the office. When the results came in, Labour had a total of 310 votes, but 311 members of Parliament had expressed no confidence in the government. It had been the first time a British government had been forced to stand down in over 50 years, and for the first time ever, a woman would be leading the Tories into a general election. 2 days after the vote of no confidence, Ari Neave was murdered when a bomb exploded under his car that was parked mere feet from the House of Commons. The Irish National Liberation Army, a splinter group from the Irish Republican Army, gloated over their deed. In March, retired terrorist and supporter of capital punishment, Ari Neave got a taste of his own medicine when an INLA unit pulled off the operation of the decade and blew him to bits inside the impregnable Palace of Westminster. The nauseous Margaret Thatcher sniveled on television that he was an incalculable loss, and so he was to the British ruling class. The man who had been instrumental in Thatcher's rise would not be there to guide her through the general election. She knew this would be her sole opportunity to become prime minister. "There's only one chance for women," she confessed. "'Tis the law of life." In their own ways, both Reagan and Thatcher present themselves as honest, tough speakers who stated their points of view and let the chips fall where they may. Yet both were acutely aware of the power of image, something no successful actor or politician can ignore. To avoid wearing glasses in public, Reagan had been one of the first Americans to get contact lenses at a time when they were still experimental. They were big, rigid, and fit over the whites of your eyes like a pair of football helmets, and weren't much fun to wear, he wrote in his autobiography. Each lens had a little bubble over your cornea that you had to keep filled with a saline solution, and every couple of hours the solution would turn gray and you'd find yourself blinded until you replaced the fluid. Similarly, even after leaving office at age 79, Reagan was still insisting that his jet black hair was all natural. "The rumor about dyeing my hair, incidentally, started when I was governor," he claimed. "My barber told me that after I left his shop, people sometimes came in and asked if they could pick up a strand or two of my hair to see if the roots were gray. I'm the first person I know of who was actually happy when gray hair started growing on his head." As for Thatcher, she got a complete image makeover to the point of secretly taking lessons to lower the tone of her speaking voice. In the lead up to the 1979 election, she was exposed for this by a BBC reporter, marking one of the extremely few cases where she found herself at a loss for words. "It's said that Gordon Rees gave you humming lessons to improve the way you spoke," he said to her. "Humming lessons?" she replied, desperately looking away from the reporter. "I'm not a very good hummer." Hence, perhaps, the need for the lessons. "Your voice is much lower than it used to be." Yes, I'm not quite sure why, whether it is that one is using it more." Her makeover was merely part of a broader, remarkably modern campaign by the Conservatives. Their slogan had consisted of three simple words: "Labor isn't working." "I can't bear Britain decline," Thatcher insisted. "I just can't. We who either defeated or rescued half Europe, who kept